Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we've got a single, pretty explosive source, and I think it's going to flip a lot of, well, conventional wisdom right on its head. We are diving deep into a really radical critique of professional religious life, and it comes straight from one of history's greatest minds, Moses Maimonides, the Rambam.
That's right.
The source is an article, The Obligation to Work and Learn a Profession, Part 2, Maimonides Tries Out. Published by Chin Cholov. And this isn't just, you know, dry histories. This is a deep cut. It challenges how modern society views the whole idea of funding spiritual or intellectual pursuits.
It really does. Our mission today is to unpack Rambam's fierce, I mean utterly uncompromising, argument against receiving stipends or salaries for the act of studying Torah, or teaching it, or judging by it.
So it's about the commercialization of knowledge.
Exactly. He sees it as a spiritual catastrophe, and we really need to get into why.
And the opening claim here, the thing that just grabs your attention, is that Maimonides doesn't see this as some minor error. He calls it a blasphemy of God, a Jilul Hashem.
Right, which is a term, you know, it's reserved for the absolute gravest of sins.
So this suggests the practice isn't just financially questionable. It's, in his view, a profound devaluation of the Torah itself.
Okay, so let's unpack that severity. Where exactly does he write this, and what's the actual ruling?
He lays it out very clearly in his major legal work, the Hilchot Talmud Torah, The Laws of Torah Study.
And what does he say?
He says that anyone who decides to forego honest labor, you know, contributing to the world through work, and instead plans to live off charity or stipends just for studying Torah, has committed Chilul Hashem. And he says they've degraded the Torah.
Degraded the Torah. That phrasing is so powerful. So the problem isn't just about being dependent. It's something about what you're doing to the Torah.
Exactly. What's the logic there? Why is it so severe?
The logic, according to the source, is that the Torah is supposed to be a tool for refining your character, for improving your thought, for getting closer to the divine. It's meant to be studied for its own sake.
For its own sake.
Right. But the second you attach a price tag to it, or you rely on it for your income, it becomes what the sages called a spade to dig with.
A spade to dig with. So it just becomes a tool, a shovel you use to get money out of the ground.
Precisely. It turns a spiritual quest into a job application. And for Maimonides, this just completely misdirects the learner's intention. He gives this core instruction, love labor and hate ravenate.
Wow.
And he warns that if you rely on study without labor, your path, well, it ultimately fails. He says it leads to sin and potentially causes a person to end up robbing others.
Because their support system is just fundamentally corrupt.
And unstable. Yes.
Okay, let me play devil's advocate here for a second. Isn't that just wildly impractical? I mean, how could a chief rabbi or a leading judge possibly hold down a second job as a woodcutter and still do their duties?
That is the central tension, and it's why his position is so radical. He just insists that the prohibition applies universally.
To everyone.
Everyone. Scholars, judges, teachers, students, city rabbis. The ban is absolute. You can't demand or accept money for your position or for the simple act of learning. The source is very clear on this. The demands of the office, for him, do not waive the moral need for honest labor.
So spiritual leaders have to contribute to the physical economy. What does he say about the value of that work?
He describes it in, well, in really glowing terms. He says working with your own hands is a great virtue, a midat chasidim.
The measure of the pious of old.
Yes, exactly. He says it's the path to reward in this world and the next, and he quotes the verse, "You shall eat the labor of your hands."
And the financial independence that comes from that work, it has other benefits too, right?
Oh, absolutely. It means you're not beholden to anyone, so your judgment can be impartial. And also, if you earn your money honorably, you actually value it, which in turn makes you able to give real, meaningful charity to others.
Okay, this is where the source just elevates the whole debate beyond practicality and into, well, deep philosophy.
It really does.
Rambam connects taking money for study to a much deeper error. Treating something holy as if it's just a physical utility, like a superstition.
This is Maimonides the philosopher at his most intense. He uses the analogy of people misinterpreting commandments, or mitzvot, as if they're physical amulets.
Like the mezuzah.
Exactly, the mezuzah.
Yeah.
He was, according to the source, just astonished by people who saw the mezuzah on the doorpost as a little charm.
A good luck charm to protect their house or their body.
Right. They were looking for worldly enjoyment, for physical security, from a spiritual text.
But its real purpose, in his view, is totally different. It's intellectual. Yeah. Spiritual.
Yes. Its purpose is to be a constant reminder, to refine the intellect, to dedicate your thoughts to God. So if you use it for physical security, you are basically denying its spiritual truth.
And he applies this to other things too, right?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
He says people who think that tzitzit binges protect the body, or who, you know, recite biblical verses over a wound or put a sacred text on a child to help them sleep. He calls them deniers of the Torah.
Okay, so let's connect that back to the money. The philosophical error isn't just about financial dependence.
No, not at all.
The real harm is turning a spiritual good into a physical commodity.
That's the parallel, precisely. Just as viewing the mezuzah as a physical safeguard is basically heresy, turning the study of Torah into a financial occupation, a source of worldly enjoyment, is profaning the truth.
You're turning a cure for the soul into a cure for the body.
You've got it. You've fundamentally changed the relationship from one of dedication to one of pure transaction.
Which makes the whole Chil Hashem, the blasphemy of God ruling, suddenly make a lot more sense. It's not about being poor. It's about spiritual integrity.
Right.
Now, we have to tackle the counterarguments because his stance is so extreme. First, what about the idea of Torah as a craft? If it's your craft, shouldn't you get paid?
That's a key nuance. The source clarifies that when Rambam says someone's Torah is their craft, this only applies if that person is already financially secure.
So they have money already?
Yes. Substantial independent wealth, like enough money to live for 10 years without working. Crucially, they cannot be receiving funds from others for the study. They're studying full-time because they can, not because they're being subsidized to do it.
Okay, and then there's the big one, the one everyone brings up, the tribe of Levi. They were supported by tithes. They didn't own land. That seems like a clear system of payment for religious service.
It does, but the source makes a very careful distinction. The Levi were set apart to serve in the temple and to teach, and their support came from the first tithe, the Mazar Rishon.
Which was a divine decree.
A divine decree, exactly. A commandment for their sustenance, their birthright. But, and this is the key, this is totally distinct from accepting a payment for the act of teaching.
So it's a kind of baseline support, not a salary.
Right. Even the Levi were expected to do some labor. The tithes just reduced the amount of work they needed to do, freeing up more time for service. It was sustenance based on lineage, not a salary based on output.
That is a vital distinction. Does this ban also extend to teaching, say, technical religious skills?
It does. The source specifies that you can't be paid for teaching a religious craft. So you couldn't charge someone to learn how to be a ritual slaughterer, a shashe, or a scribe, a sofer stam.
But you can get paid for the work itself.
Exactly. You can be paid for the act of slaughtering the animal, or for the labor of writing a scroll. That's a tangible service. But the knowledge itself, the teaching of the sacred skill, must remain free.
The knowledge must be free, but the application can be a service. That's a fine line.
It's a critical one, and this ties into the social contract. The source says parents are obligated to teach their children an honorable profession. If you don't, you're essentially setting them on that path to using the Torah as a spade to dig with.
This wasn't just theory for him. I mean, the greatest minds of the past actually live this way. And these stories, they really bring the law to life.
They absolutely do.
Let's start with Hillel the Elder. I mean, maybe the most influential figure of his time. His students were compared to Moses and Joshua, but he was a woodcutter.
A simple woodcutter studying in extreme poverty. And the sources say that if he had ever agreed to take support, his community would have showered him with it. They never would have let him keep cutting wood.
So it was a choice, a deliberate choice.
Completely deliberate. He chose the sanctity of self-sufficiency, and he wasn't alone. You have Rav Yosef, who also carried wood. He famously said, "Great is labor, for it warms its owner."
He didn't just mean physically warm.
No, he meant the dignity, the contentment that comes from honest work.
And then there's the judge, Karna.
An amazing example. He was the judge for all of Israel, the highest post, and he irrigated fields for a living. When people came for a judgment, he only charged them for the work time he was losing.
Wait, say that again? He charged for the lost wages from his farming?
But not for the judgment itself. He was selling his time, not his Torah wisdom.
That is a phenomenal distinction. But maybe the most powerful story, the one that really shows the gravity of this, is about Rabbi Tarfon.
It really gets to the heart of the matter. R. Tarfon was a very wealthy man. One day, he's in a vineyard, and the owner mistakes him for a thief.
Okay.
The owner grabs him, throws him in a sack, and starts running to the river to drown him.
So to save his life, R. Tarfon has to do something.
He's forced to reveal his identity. He shouts, "I am Rabbi Tarfon." The owner, horrified, immediately lets him go out of respect.
But he wasn't relieved.
No. For the rest of his life, he lamented this. He was pained by it. He said, "Woe is me, for I have made use of the crown of the Torah."
Wow.
He regretted that he didn't just use his money to save himself. Instead, he used his scholarly prestige to gain a physical benefit safety. And he saw that as a terrible failing.
That is powerful. The sanctity of the Torah had to be protected even from, well, its incidental use. So if payment is forbidden, how can the community support scholars? It seems impossible.
Well, the source clarifies that there are permissible ways, but they're defined as honors or privileges, never as a transactional salary.
Okay, give us an example. What's a permissible honor?
Maimonides allowed people to provide money for a scholar to use in trade or investment. Basically, you could set the scholar up in a business or give them priority in the market. The income comes from trade, not from study.
That makes sense. What else?
A huge one was exemption from all governmental duties and taxes.
All of them?
All of them. Head tax, host fees, contributions for public works, even if the scholar was wealthy. The source cites a ruling where a rich scholar in Andalusia was freed from a massive 1,000 dinar tax purely because he was a scholar committed to his labor and his learning.
That's a huge societal honor. It's not a paycheck.
Not at all. And finally, you have basic hospitality when traveling. A meal, a place to stay. But the source warns scholars not to take advantage of this, not to demand feasts. The line has to be crystal clear.
And when you pull it all together, you see Rambam looking at his own time. And he's just bewildered.
He's astonished. He wrote that he couldn't understand how the great men of his generation were so blinded by greed that they just ignored the plain truth of the texts. He believed they twisted the sources to justify taking stipends, when the truth was that everyone should contribute to the settlement of the world through labor.
Okay, so let's distill this for you, our listener. The core tension here is a choice between two paths. Do you see knowledge, spiritual, intellectual, whatever, as a sacred tool for refinement, something that has to be protected from commercial taint?
Or do you treat it as a specialized commodity, something to be bought and sold like any other professional service? Maimonides was fighting for the former.
Which leaves us with a pretty provocative question to think about.
A very provocative question. If the true measure of wisdom is found in being able to sustain yourself through honest work while also pursuing the highest intellectual goals, what modern fields, what professions do you think are similarly corrupted when they become the sole means of earning a living instead of serving some higher, untainted purpose?
That challenge of balancing utility and integrity, that's Maimonides' enduring gift to us.